We'll go ahead and get started.
Are you working Bobby too hard?
Probably, mm-hmm. You know. I don't know what that even means. I was playing. We're busy. We got all kinds of stuff going on, and a lot of this stuff too. So,
okay.
In any case, this is the ninth Genesis class. We are in Genesis 6, and we'll try to finish 6 and 7 tonight. The last class we spent doing quite a bit of work on time frames and timelines, trying to get things sorted out. The idea behind the class is, you know, we study the Word of the Bible, and we study it very, very closely and very carefully. And we study it with an eye on original languages and an eye on sort of logic and trying to get deeper into it and trying to figure out some of the puzzles. When we do something like Acts or James, there may not be a lot of that to do. But when we do something like Genesis, there is an extraordinary amount of that type of work to do. And so the first thing I have is a present for everybody. So I'll pass some of these around. I got more for the people that aren't here. But a few weeks ago, people were asking if I could put all this stuff together into some kind of chart. And, you know, a couple hundred hours later, wow. Here it is.
Thank you.
So just pass that. Okay. Like every couple gets one or whatever.
Okay.
However you want to do it. Pass that around. There you go. I'll send another couple down there. So let me tell you what it is. I threw it together real fast yesterday, the intro part, just to get it printed for you. So there's a couple typos in that first intro part, and I've kind of rewritten all that now a little bit more in depth in the middle of last night. But I wanted to get it printed out in time. But this is the chart, and you'll see that it starts roughly 3000 BC, give or take, and that we've cross-referenced the Pharaoh list from all the research in Egypt, the dates, the Bible, Samaria, Akkadia, Babylon, Assyria, Persia, and then on the last column, just for kicks and giggles, I wanted to give everybody the world wonders, a little bit of China, and some of the Americas, just so everybody could kind of see what was going on. You could, you know, take a few minutes to look at that at some point, but you'll see, for instance, on page 5 of that, you'll see the when the founding of Babylon was, and as you keep turning pages, you'll see Joseph arrive in Egypt, and you'll see the Exodus and all that stuff. There's a couple sections where there's some two different kingdoms running simultaneously, but you'll start with what we discovered last time in the last class with the dates on Moses and everything, and that's on page 10 and 11, and you'll see all that stuff concerning the Exodus. And then after that, for everybody's future use, I filled in every other character in the Old Testament, so real quick. So David's in there, and Solomon, and all the kings, and Hosea, and Isaiah, and Judah, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you'll continue through there, and you'll see all kinds of cool stuff. And that's just for you to do whatever you want to with. The results of all this research, you know, it's been quite a few hundred hours. It's just been, for me, you know, it's just been kind of astounding. I trust the Bible no matter what anyway, but to see dramatic, in-depth, intimate cross-referencing in non-biblical cultures is just sort of shocking. The big one, the big recent one for me is on page 14, and I was, you guys remember the story of Sennacherib, who was an Assyrian king who laid siege to Jerusalem. My theory was that if we cross-reference that, it's around 700 BC, give or take. that the idea was, if we cross-reference that with the biblical story, that's the one where 185,000 Assyrians are killed by an angel in the middle of the night. It's one of the coolest stories in the Bible. Okay, Hezekiah was the king, Isaiah was the prophet, and that's when he laid out the letter. I don't know if you guys probably remember that story. Very cool stuff. Anyway, there would be some kind of mention, you know, if we could find Sennacherib's records in Assyria, and then he just talked about conquering Israel, then, you know, what could we discover? And to my amazement and wonder, Sennacherib has a stele. And a stele is a, you know, as we've discussed before, it's a large stone sort of obelisk that has recorded the history of the leader. And there's three copies. He was a very powerful, important Assyrian leader, and so he has three copies in three different places. It's the kind of thing you'd put up somewhere to scare people, you know. It's like when Vlad put the heads of the Ottoman Turks on the pikes along the road to scare everybody off. It's the ancient version of that. When you put the stele out, and the people come along and they read it, and they say, "Oh my goodness, we should not mess with these guys," right? Well, he talks about 40-plus cities that he took and goes through it very carefully. In the Bible, it says he basically summarizes that he took all the cities and he was laying siege to Jerusalem, and then the angel killed 185,000 and he left. In his stele, which wouldn't record the giant loss because that wouldn't scare anybody, right? It just says he laid siege to Jerusalem and it didn't work and he left. So that's confirmed by Assyrian records. That kind of stuff just blows my mind. But you can go through there and look at when all kinds of fun stuff. Like, for instance, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon were started the same year that Daniel arrived. I don't know if there's any connection there, but it's pretty cool. Senor? So, hang on to that, and that'll be extended into stuff as we go through the future, but I want everybody to have a copy. So if you're out there doing some kind of study of something and you want to cross-reference something, that'll help. So anyway, knock that puppy out and we can keep rolling.
Thank you.
No problem. So the reason we started all that was we were trying to date the flood, which is basically impossible. So we're trying to date the flood. We don't know for 100% sure. But we do have a cross-referencing so deep now that we realize that right around that 3000-ish BC range is when all the recorded history from various cultures throughout the world begins. It's very odd that all this history begins sort of simultaneously around the world. It's very strange because a great deal of, say, atheist historians and scientists, they don't talk about that. But it's odd that you would have all the cultures of the world start almost simultaneously, and that would be in the record, and that would be all the scientists going, yes, that's true, but obviously the Bible's not. I mean, that's just very odd. So we need more cross-referencing going on, but unfortunately, as we've discussed before, you know, the different camps don't like to cross-reference each other. You know, scientists and their group of folks, you know, that are atheists or agnostic, don't really like to reference the Bible, and biblical scholars that, you know, are believers don't really like to reference atheist scientists and historians, and so the battle rages on, which is a useless waste of time, that entire battle. But whatever, people do what they want to do, and that's cool, and, you know, God bless them, let them roll on with whatever museum they want to build next, and it's all good. But it's pretty clear when you study everything side by side, like that chart, that everything matches, that it works together. And so now we're still back on the flood, and we're still trying to figure out what's going on. So we're into Genesis 6, and we dealt with two classes ago one of the toughest parts of the Bible, which is right before the flood, and the discussion of the Nephilim, which we've covered already. And now we're going to get to this flood. Now, in essence, you have a series of, you know, it tends to be about three different positions that we lay out. And we don't come hard down on one side usually, and we don't like batter people over the head with a baseball bat about whatever the position is. But as you remember, we had three positions concerning Eden, and we have three positions concerning the Exodus, and we're going to have some positions concerning Noah and the flood. These positions aren't that we want to have them. These positions are because we don't have 100% of all the answers all the time, which means that we have to have discussion. And I'll give you an example. I'll give you a really easy example of why we have those discussions. So take a look. Let's look at Genesis 8:20. This is just an example of why we have a class like this and why we go through this. And this says, plainly and clearly in the Bible, the waters prevailed 15 cubits upward and the mountains were covered. Well, 15 cubits is approximately a couple hundred feet, which is going to be really deep, obviously. But that doesn't cover mountains. So what does that mean? That's why we have class, okay? That's why we try to figure these things out. So we know that we've got Noah and his family going into the ark, but we also know that he's very old. So how big is this group of people going to the ark? It lists a few people. Are those the only people in the ark? So you could take the position that, yeah, it lists the exact people, him and his three sons and their wives, and they have these, you know, 7, 8 people, whatever. That's the number of people in the ark, and it's plain and simple. Or is it? So, Andy, how old is Noah when they go in the ark?
600
years old, right? And he could just have three kids, and they could have, like, no kids. But that's not very likely. Do we have any evidence of culture or biblical discussion that would lead us to believe it might be more than that number? Well, for that, and a look at that culture, we can look at the way in which the feeding of the 5,000 is described. And I won't make everybody do sword drills and go to verse after verse after verse, but if you look at the feeding of the 5,000 in the New Testament, you'll notice that there's several accounts, and they don't disagree. What they do is add to each other. And we discover, when we study this, that there are 5,000, and that one account says 5,000 people, right? The next account says 5,000 men, and there's women and children also. And if we go back through the study of all of the lineage up to this point, we discover that there's a habit within this culture and within the descriptions up to this point within Genesis to describe several family members and then say, and a bunch more people, right? So we have a completely plausible concept that there could be a great deal of people on the ark, okay? It could be those, or could be the leaders. That could be the leading family. And there could be hundreds of other people, right? You would describe it like that in that culture. Or it could be just those people. Now, that's not super clear. Maybe it'll help when we discover, or we decide, and you decide, if you think that this flood was 15 cubits deep, or covered all the mountains of the earth, or was regional, or was worldwide, but you're going to need to come up with that answer as well. You describe things within the culture of the ancient world a lot of times as, like, Alexander the Great conquered the world, right? That's how you would describe that. The Romans own the world. Now, it's not the whole world. It's a very huge region. So that terminology can be interpreted as, indeed, the entire world. Or it can be interpreted as a larger region. So this is why we have these discussions. And you're going to have to read and pray, and you're going to have to deal with the Holy Spirit and God and the Word and your heart and go through all of these things to figure out where you stand. There's a bunch of different answers. For instance, you could have that exact number of people that's listed and no one else. You could have a regional flood. You could have an entire world flooded with that number of people that then repopulate it. That's going to require a big act of God, which of course is fine. You can say, well, you know, if you like we talked about the three positions in Eden. There's the one that we learned our whole lives, that almost all of us learned, where Adam and Eve were the first two people on the planet. And that doesn't really match the way the text reads. And there's a couple problems with it as you read the text with that idea. But if you had that idea and you decided to try to argue with yourself about that, you said, well, two people and genetics and the way the genome thing works and all that stuff, could God just fix that? Sure. Say, for the first couple generations, none of that counts. God could do whatever he wants to do, right? But there's additional textual problems with that outlook. For instance, the fact that the timing in Genesis 1 and the way in which humans are made and the way in which animals are made, there's a time frame. And that doesn't match the way in which Adam and Eve are made and the way in which the animals are presented to Adam to name. That's the reverse of Genesis 1, which means that either God made other animals out of the dirt to show Adam to name them. This is a giraffe or whatever. And it was, in fact, back in day 6. Or they weren't. It was what we call the Eden experiment, where God made his people his way with his requirements about the tree and all this other stuff to test obedience and have some personal relationships. Which would explain a lot of stuff, like where Cain got a wife or why people lived 900 years. If they were originally made to be immortal and now they're in the world as humans, but the 10 generations in a row lives 900 years, and they almost all live the same roughly amount of time, 900 and some change, which is extremely weird for humans. So you've got to figure out what you think about that. Is that, you know, real years? Is it God time? Is it just extra blessings? Is it some kind of genetic code that came out of Eden? I mean, it sounds like we're talking about crazy stuff, but we're not. We're just talking about the Bible and what it says, and we're trying to figure it out. And it says some pretty crazy stuff. The beginning of Genesis 6 says that the sons of God found the daughters of men attractive and came and had children with them. That's in there. I didn't make that up. I'm not trying to write a script for Spielberg, okay? That's in there. So you have to come to grips with what that means. Is that like, you know, the majority opinion is that that's angels and human women. If that's true, A, what, you know, how does that work? B, did it stop? I hope so, right? And if it did, then why did it stop? Now, I have theological answers for all those questions, right? I believe that if that would have, if that, for instance, was the case, then it would have been stopped, for instance, by Jesus. And he visits, when he's dead, he visits a place where it says those spirits are in chains. They're imprisoned to minister to them. And so it appears as though those people may have been punished, right, for what they did. That's biblical. But once again, it's not specific enough. It could be anything else. It could be other answers too. So this is why we go through this. And we picked, you know, the hardest book of the Bible to go through this with. It's much easier to discuss Acts. But that's okay. Here's the next question for today. Could the ark hold all the animals? Okay, so see the board. So that's the measurements of the ark. And we read as we continue through Genesis 6. And God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it a cubit from above, and set the door of the ark in its side. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. This is pretty specific. God's given him the floor plans. And behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy them under heaven, all flesh in which is breath of life. Everything that is in the earth shall die, but I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you, and every living thing of all flesh. You shall bring two of every sort in the ark and keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female, of the birds after their kind, etc. So here's the next question mark. You read that, and it says, of every living thing you shall bring two of every sort into the ark and keep them alive with you. Next chapter, 7:2, take seven of each clean animal, a male and a female, two of each of the animals that are unclean, a male and a female, also seven each of the birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of the earth. Okay. The terminology being used is pretty dramatic and pretty large. It appears to be, and the reason we've learned this traditionally, is because it appears to be the whole earth, right? In addition, we've encountered, as I read last time, these flood stories existing in Native American culture, in Native South American culture, in Aboriginal Australian culture, in African culture, in the Maasai. Multiple of these stories have stories of building a boat. Multiple of these stories have a story of a rainbow afterwards. They have a lot in common. They have different reasons, because those cultures didn't necessarily have the God of Abraham in their lives. They didn't necessarily have scripture or these ideas. So they came up with their own descriptions, and usually it involved making God mad and he floods the planet. But the fact that it exists in so many places is quite odd. As we speak, Chinese geologists are hard at work in what they consider to be a great floodplain in China. That's roughly as old as what we're talking about. So, another scientist operating some deep sea diving equipment in the Black Sea found a shoreline from at least several thousand BC that looks like it used to be an old shore before some kind of great flood occurred. It's not stretching the limits of scientific rationale to suggest an incredible flood. Bless you. Just like it's not to suggest that a meteor struck the earth and killed dinosaurs or whatever. These types of things can happen on the planet. We just have to decide how we feel about exactly what that means. Does every animal from every part of the planet come to Noah sitting there in roughly Babylon? So do, you know, rainforest monkeys from Brazil get to him somehow? And if so, how? Right? God can move them, of course. He can bring them himself any way he wants. So
it says they got there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so you're talking about a pretty amazing, event. They're going to see, if that's the case, they're going to see a whole lot of crazy things they've never seen before. Mm-hmm. I can just imagine Noah with an anaconda coming up, and he's like, whoa, now we've never seen anything. Maybe that explains the garden, because that thing is like 40 feet long. I don't know, but it's pretty amazing. But we have some variations here that we would have to dig into as to how many of each animal and all that stuff. The question is, how big is that? Well, again, we have to do research. The reason we have things like that booklet and all that cross-referencing is because everybody disagrees about what a cubit is, right? And the reason they disagree is because cubit has changed lengths over time. It's changed its size from different cultures at different times. Sort of like right now, we might measure things by yards, and other people might measure things by meters, right? Things change. Well, that's changed. And it got shorter later. Some really in-depth research would lead us to this 20.5 foot cubit. Now, that's not a common belief, because people go to biblical times to get the answer on cubit. But the problem is, this is pre sort of biblical times, right? This is Noah. And we don't know the exact time frame, but if we get close to, say, somewhere between 2,500 and 3,000 years ago, we're not dealing with Hebrew culture. We're not dealing with anything like that. So if they were measuring Solomon's temple in cubits, it would be a very different measurement system than we're talking about, even though it seems to be the Old Testament, right? We're back way before that. And as you know, we're in a region basically equivalent to Babylon or Samaria. And so when you look at the ancient 3,000-ish time frame, you know, measuring it more like maybe the pyramids were measured, you get a bigger measurement. So I've given you a couple options on the board. But what they do is, the low end is 400 and some change. The high end is 500 and some change. So most people just settle on 450 because it's kind of in the middle. They're like, that's pretty close. And you'll see people do that. If they have a range, they'll just go, okay, so he could be born here and he could be born here, so we'll just go with that one. In this case, the smallest possible probable size, 450, this is in feet, times 75 times 45. That's a small one. I like the ancient Babylonian measurements better. There, I think they'd probably be closer. But that's a 1.5 million cubic feet. That's what that is. So that's 500 plus boxcars, of like a train boxcar, maybe 550, depending on which measurement you use. It's a lot of animals.
It'd be quite a circus.
That's a lot of animals. We're talking about 150, probably 150,000 sheep-sized animals could fit in there. So that's a lot of animals. We'd have to spend another couple weeks in all the zoology texts and on the phone to, you know, San Diego to discover if that could fit basically all the animals. But it's pretty close. It's going to be a great deal of animals. So you can decide what you think about that, and how many people you think are on the ark. But I will tell you that no matter what, we have a very clear, very dramatic, earth-changing event that's happening right now. So the Lord said to Noah, Genesis 7, "Come into the ark, you and all your household, because I've seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. You shall take with you seven of each every." So the question is this. You get, in one verse, you get a fairly specific total of people, right? You get Shem, Ham, Japheth, their wives. In another sentence, you get your entire household. In one sentence, you get two of each animal. Another sentence, you get seven of certain animals, two of other animals. Now, what do we know? We know there's no such thing as a biblical error, which means we either have a translational error or an understanding problem. Typically, it's an understanding problem where we're just trying to sort stuff out and we really don't know exactly how to do it. But I will point out that there's two things that God says in these chapters that make anything possible. And here is the first one. So he says, this is God himself speaking, okay? And he says that he is going to bring water onto the earth. Now what that means is, if God says, I'm going to bring water on the earth, then we don't necessarily have to be able to account for all that water today. You understand what I mean? One of the big discussions is, if you calculate, and scientists have done this, Christian scientists have done this, if you calculate the amount of water on the planet, right, all the ice caps, their thickness, all the oceans, their depth, etc. If you calculate all the water on the planet, and you want to say that all the mountains of the planet are covered, there's not enough water on the planet to do that, right? So that's a scientific reason to believe it possibly might be lower than a mountain, or perhaps it might be regional or whatever. But if God says he's going to bring water on the earth to do that, it doesn't necessarily have to be natural. So we have, throughout the Bible and throughout our own lives, supernatural things occurring. So it doesn't have to always make complete sense. It's nice when it does, right? But it doesn't always have to make sense. Sometimes it just is. Like we've studied when we, you know, during Easter when we do the time frame and we discover what happened that last week to Jesus, to go through all of that and have no broken bones is virtually impossible. And yet we know that no bones were broken. But he was shredded for days, but no bones were broken. Sometimes you just have to read that and go, all right. And so if you want to take the position that the entire earth is about to be covered with water over all the mountains on the entire planet, take that position. Because God can do that. That's nothing. Think about thousands of galaxies. Covering a planet with water is like, that's like not even as complicated as an oak tree, honestly. Just make a bunch of water. God can do that anytime he wants. So if you're looking for all that water and you need a scientific explanation, then you might want to go with covering some mountains or regional. Or you might want to go with my favorite alternative explanation from a Christian astrologer who likes the idea of a water comet hitting the earth and dumping billions of cubic feet of water on the planet. Although if that was what had happened, there probably would be remnants of that water still. So that's, you know, that's a questionable theory. But hey, that's his way of understanding. All we know is that whether it's all the local people or all the people period on the planet, basically everyone's about to die. And that's really sad. But we've already been through why, and we've been through some really scary whys, like the idea of the Nephilim and all these other things we've talked about. If there are, and this is biblically sound and fairly conservative, what I'm about to say, even though it sounds insane, if there are angel-human crossbreed people running around the planet, you're going to need to flood the planet. If you're going to have to do something about it. And if they're creating all kinds of mayhem and evil is running everything. And we've talked about a theological reason for that, right? I mean, you have to have a plan of how you're dealing with God and how God's dealing with people. There has to be a plan. And with Eden, there was a plan. God walked in the cool of the day with Adam. Adam and Eve dealt directly with God. They were going to be immortal. They didn't have age or illness or anything. Everything was awesome. That was a plan. And we're going to have a plan later. We're going to have a covenant with Noah. We're going to have a covenant with Abraham. We're going to have a Mosaic covenant that covers, you know, 1,000 years of how to do stuff and how the temple and how the tabernacle work and all this. There's going to be a plan. And then that plan's not going to work, so we're going to have Jesus, the ultimate plan. And we're going to have, when Jesus goes to the Father, we're going to have the Holy Spirit sent back. And so we always have a plan for communication with God, except for a hiccup time. And that hiccup time is before the flood. It's after Eden. It's before the flood. And there's no plan. So everybody's just running amok, basically. And if everybody's running amok and nobody has a plan of communicating with God and serving God, and there's just random people like Noah happens to be a really holy guy, which is great, but there's no real plan in place, you're going to degenerate rapidly into something pretty horrific. We know what people are capable of, right? We've seen, you know, History Channel specials on Auschwitz, right? We know what human beings are capable of. And if they're running amok and they have, you know, evil living among them in some type of supernatural way, then you got to do something. So, I mean, I don't really have a big problem with that. A lot of philosophers, a lot of commenters have a problem with you know, how can a great God that's love and good, you know, kill everybody like that? My answer is, you weren't there before the flood, but I'd be willing to bet you'd be begging him to kill everybody if you were. So these are tough. These are tough questions. But the flood's going to be on the earth for 40 days. The waters are going to increase, and they're going to lift up the ark, and they're going to rise high above the earth. The waters prevailed and greatly increased on the earth. And the ark moved about on the surface of the waters. And the waters prevailed exceedingly on the earth. It says it multiple times. And all the high hills under the whole heaven were covered. The water prevailed 15 cubits upward, and the mountains were covered. So how can you read that? If you are a all mountains covered person, 15 cubits, the water prevailed 15 cubits upward, the mountains were covered. In other words, the water prevailed 15 cubits over the mountains. Another mountain, the highest mountain was covered by 15 cubits, right? A couple hundred feet of water over the top of the mountain. And all the flesh died that moved on the earth, birds and cattle and beasts and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth and every man, all in whose nostril was the breath of the spirit of life, all that was on the dry land died. So he destroyed all living things which were on the face of the ground, both man and cattle, creeping thing and bird of the air. They were destroyed from the earth. Only Noah and those who were with him in the ark remained alive, and the water prevailed on the earth for 150 days. So, all that was on the dry land died. So, at the very least, he didn't have to collect all the fish. Okay? So, the fish are good. The fish are good.
The fish had a feast.
The fish had a feast. The birds of the air. It's interesting. So, the first time you think about that, you think, that's strange. So, water's rising, killing birds. That's weird. That doesn't make any sense, right? Until you realize that there's no place for a bird to land. Mm-hmm. Right? And if there's no variation in the surface temperature because the entire surface is water, then there's no updraft to keep them soaring. So they're going to land in the water and drown. Unless, of course, they are water birds, which would be theoretically not a dry land creature. I'm just saying. I'm just out there in the biological universe trying to go, what about ducks? So, and of course, that's all discussion, because you could kill everything that was left on the dry land, just like it says. But what about things that aren't left on the dry land? So your fish are good, your whales and your octopuses and all that stuff, octopi, are all good. So now we need to figure out something. And this is the big philosophical discussion of Genesis 6 and 7 for us to figure out. And I want everybody to kind of comment. Okay. Does anybody else have a boat? So there's several positions. Position number one, never been water on the earth before, never been rain before. This is a pretty hardcore conservative position, but it exists. Okay, it's existed for hundreds of years. Never been rain on the earth before, never been any water like this, so no, nobody has boats. Now, that doesn't make sense because we know back in Genesis 1 that the earth and the earth was separated from the seas. The dry land and the oceans were separated. So there are oceans. There's water, bodies of water on the planet from before man. We know that there are a lot of cultures in the world from this time frame. Like I said, we tried to nail this time frame down and have not succeeded, so everything we say is with a little grain of salt, right? Or more like a salt lick. But anyway, we do our best. But there's a lot of cultures from this time frame that are seafaring cultures that have the ability, you know, for instance, the Egyptians. They're up and down the Nile all the time on stuff, right? Most of the cultures of the time frame are built on rivers. And so the idea of having boats is not alien. Or is it? Is this the first time a boat has ever been made? Or are there other people with boats? If there are other people with boats, then you have a couple options. God can sink all the boats. He can do that. That's easy. Just make the storm really rough, which it probably would be when you cover all the mountains with water. It'd probably be kind of rough seas. Okay? So you can easily create a storm unlike the likes of which humans have never seen and sink all the boats except for the Ark, because it's the biggest probably at the time. We're talking roughly Titanic size. I mean, this thing is huge, right? It's not like Nimitz class size, you know, carrier size, but it's huge. And so it would be bigger than all those other boats at the time, so you could sink all the little boats and the Ark could still float. Of course, God could protect it anyway. You understand what I'm saying? What do you think? Do you think there's cultures in the world? Do you think there's boats? Do you think there's people sitting in, when it starts to rain, 400 miles away from Noah, when it starts to rain, does somebody run and get in their boat? Or does everybody die? Or do those people count as people that aren't on the dry land? Because they're in a boat. Comments? The
Bible says they all die.
Everybody.
Except Noah and his family.
Okay.
That's what I read.
That's certainly what we've all been taught, right? That's certainly the classical understanding of the text, which typically is a correct understanding. We've been studying this stuff for thousands of years. So it's not like people just made up a new understanding. I mean, people have been working on this for a long, long time. And it certainly appears to be, you know, that certainly appears to be the answer. All flesh, you know, being killed. Other comments?
Well, typically, any other boats probably would not have roofs on them. So they would just be filled up with water.
Oh, this is great. That's good. This is great.
That's good.
It had to be pretty rough water, too, and small boats aren't.
This is great. So all the other guys, which probably don't have roofs on their boats, because why would you build a boat with a roof, right? Almost no one ever did that. So maybe all the open boats get filled with water, and that's great. That's great. So everybody's like trying to be in a boat. So maybe only like maybe Goliath's great-great-grandfather could bail really fast. You know, maybe he just was like, yeah, I don't know.
Well, there was two guys that were probably there. There's one guy named Evan Rude and the other guy's name is Mercury. And they had boats and motors, yeah. Surely by them.
So. And really good ones. Did Noah have the seat really up front with the swivel where you could do all the casting? Was that the bass?
Surely he was fishing for bass or whales or something.
Hilarious for whales.
Sharks.
I think that kind of discussion is fascinating. Now we have, so let's discuss this. So when we try to get answers in this serious discussion that we're in, we keep getting in trouble with direct answers. And I'll send you back to Genesis 6. 4. We're talking about the Nephilim again, and it says there were giants on the earth in those days and also afterward. Come on. Can I get a break? You know, because that says, okay, basically everybody's going to be killed, but also afterward. Does that mean between that description and the flood, or does that mean after the flood there were some of these people that survived? Now, if you go forward in time to the invasion of Canaan, you're going to be dealing with two references in the Old Testament, one to a king and one to a giant. And both of these references refer to a relationship to pre-flood people. Now, there are not many references, like one or two. But this is ostensibly the reason that some of the tribes in Canaan had to be completely wiped out, because there was some type of remnant. And one was a king and one was a giant, they talk about. Now, my question is, if those guys were there, and like I said, we're way out in, you know, theoretical water, literally water, but did they survive? It's interesting to me that the culture, for instance, and I'll just throw this out there, it's interesting to me that the culture that these people are from, when we get to that stage of the Bible, the invasion of Cana, it's interesting to me that culture is described in not only the Bible, but throughout all of the other references as a seafaring culture. We're talking about Philistines, for instance. The Philistines are described as a seafaring culture. They worship a fish god, okay, like a demon fish god thing. Dagon, right? So,